Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media.
Welcome to Earth Eats, a show of real food and green living. I'm Annie Corrigan.
Culturally around the world, I mean, Italy, France, the British, rabbit is extremely common and a real delicacy in all those cultures.
That's farmer and food activist Joel Salatin. He's talking about the star of our second recipe in today's program, rabbit stew, in honor of the Easter Bunny, of course. Before that, we learn about how food plays a role in the celebration of the Passover Seder. Then it's two recipes in the Jewish food tradition, potato latkes and tzimmes, two great ways to use up the last few root veggies in your crisper. That's all coming up on Earth Eats. Mia Partlow is here with the foodie headlines making news these days. Welcome, Mia.
Hi again. Remember the Just Label It campaign? Its aim was to urge the FDA to label GMOs. Last Tuesday was the deadline for the FDA to respond to the petition, and their anticlimactic response was basically, "We have nothing to say." Organizers reported the campaign garnered more than 1 million supporters, which is by far more than any other petition has ever brought to the FDA. But the FDA disagrees. By its count, the number is 394 signatures. The fight to have GMOs labeled is surely to be continued. Remember pink slime, the processed beef trimmings that have recently been grossing out meat eaters? Well, not everyone is opposed to the stuff. The governors of Iowa, Kansas, Nebraska, Texas, and South Dakota issued a statement saying lean, finely textured beef is safe and backed by sound science. About the recent public uproar, they say, quote, "It is unfortunate when inaccurate information causes an unnecessary panic among consumers," unquote. And remember the yet-to-be-passed 2012 Farm Bill? Well, it still doesn't exist. But hearings began again on March 30th, and we may finally be seeing bigger movement on it in May. Senator Debbie Stabenow, chair of the Senate Agriculture Committee, and Pat Roberts, its ranking member, hope to push the bill through committee within the coming weeks. The Farm Bill's challenges all come down to budget, of course. The Republican House want to cut $180 billion from the USDA as part of the overall budget bill. The Democratic Senate is expected to block it. Senator Roberts has already denounced the increasing number of USDA programs geared toward supporting the local food movement, saying, quote, "I caution that the belief that locally grown and purchased food is inherently better, safer, or more environmentally sustainable," unquote. In March, the National Sustainable Agriculture Coalition brought small farmers to Washington to speak with congressmen working on the Farm Bill. Jeff Everd, owner-operator of Life Certified Organic Farm, was recruited to speak to legislators about funding research, outreach, and education for small farmers in Indiana.
My presence in Washington was to let them know that we are an underserved sector of agriculture.
Everd explains that over a half century ago, when research and developmental resources were focused on the country's soy and corn production, yields increased. He believes if similar resources are devoted to organic systems, small farms like this could also see increased yields. But Everd says farming efficiency is about more than just yields.
We don't take into account any of the environmental services that organic systems do. We don't take into account any of the environmental services that are being destroyed by the chemical input systems that we're using currently.
He acknowledges there are some hurdles to leap before organic production can compete with conventional farming, specifically when it comes to the economic impact. Conventional farming systems produce revenue through the use of chemicals and machinery.
Can we have an organic chemical industry? Can we have an organic machinery industry? All of these things are good for the economy. If we were to switch over to an organic, less input-driven system, where are we going to get the revenues?
What do you think the 2012 Farm Bill should look like? Join the conversation on our website, where you can read articles from our archives about how we got here in the first place. It's at eartheats.org.
And our Twitter feed and our Facebook page are the places to go to find out the latest news on the Farm Bill. and pink slime and the labeling of GMOs and a whole bunch of other issues. And we're also on Pinterest now. Search for Earth Eats on your Pinterest page. Mia Partlow brings us news headlines every week. Thanks.
My pleasure.
U.S. farmers made almost $98 billion last year, the most ever. High commodity prices and surging productivity have touched off a run on farmland, a jump in manufacturing, and even boosted a curious sort of farm-related export. Frank Morris from Harvest Public Media explains.
Across the plains, farmers are gearing up for spring planting. Farm stores are humming.
Thanks,
okay.
Bill.
At the Farmers Co-op in Spring Hill, Kansas, a steady stream of men in hard-worn canvas jackets line up to buy fertilizer. Rita Cooper says her customers are investing heavily in next fall's harvest.
They are going ahead and, you know, committing to the dollars, committing to the orders, planting, getting it into the ground, and yes, they are doing that extra above and beyond to get the crop.
Wasn't always this way. In the 1980s, tens of thousands of farmers went broke and were forced off their land. Huge farm aid concerts raised money to help some hang on. Brutal hard times and foreclosures went on for years. But Jason Henderson, who runs the Omaha branch of the Kansas City Federal Reserve Bank, says all that's changed now.
Over the last 2-3 years, the U.S. farm sector has been enjoying banner farm incomes. It's been a real boom time.
Farm income has shot up almost 30% each of the last 2 years. Chad Hart at the University of Iowa says both prices and production are high.
As we look at the 2011 corn and soybean crops in this country, they're probably the most valuable crops we've ever produced.
The corn crop alone is worth well over $76 billion. Two major factors drive demand. Exports have surged to new record levels. China is the top importer. Domestic consumption is up, too, fueled by a huge rise in ethanol production. It adds up to high prices and happy farmers.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, can't complain. Prices have been real good. Crops ain't been bad, either.
Smile lines plow deep into Rick Kroll's face. He's here at the Western Farm Show in Kansas City, where farmers and their whole families check out the latest tractors and farm implements. Thanks in part to these enormous and incredibly precise machines, modern farmers can work much more land and get 2 or 3 times more grain off each bit of it than their fathers did. When farmers have money, they tend to buy 1 of 2 things, land or equipment, and prices for both have shot up dramatically. Kroll is eyeing a $200,000 tractor while some of his younger relations climb on it.
Come on, little buddy. You ready to go? Hey, Danny, my birthday's Tuesday.
Buy it?
Yeah, just go ahead and buy it for me. Feel free.
Kroll's joking, but many larger-scale farmers like Paul Vaver from Nebraska are feeling pretty free these past few years.
Yeah, I bought a combine and a couple John Deere tractors, yeah. Yeah, gets up there pretty expensive, you know.
A couple of big tractors and a combine could run you well over $1 million and take months to deliver. Ernie Vizzi, who, like many men here, sports a John Deere shirt and a serious mustache, sells equipment as fast as he can get it.
The company is making machines practically as fast as they can make them.
Farm equipment factories are producing jobs twice as fast as the rest of the manufacturing sector. All that new equipment flooding into the market presents another opportunity for guys like Manny De La Fuente.
You end up with all this used machinery, and you got to have a place to put it. So overseas is hungry for this equipment.
De La Fuente is the export manager for Aaron's Brothers. The company regularly ships trade-in tractors and combines from Illinois to Africa, the former Soviet bloc countries, and Latin America. He says his exports have jumped 50% in 2 years.
Business is up. So 2011 was good, and 2012 is going to be even better.
The forecast for agriculture as a whole is not quite as rosy. Back at the farm show, John Mino just bought a used combine, but sees leaner times coming.
No, I think it's a cycle. I think we'll see some tough years ahead. So hang on, have a few good years, and get ready for something else.
Economists say the boom in agriculture may have hit its peak. They predict farm incomes will fall slightly this year, but remain close to historic highs. Frank Morris, Harvest Public Media.
Read and listen to more from the reporting team at Harvest Public Media on their website, harvestpublicmedia.org. A Seder marks the beginning of Passover. It's a time for families to gather around the dining room table and recount the biblical story of Exodus as told with food. The Earth Eats crew went over to the local Hillel Center to talk with its executive director, Rabbi Sue Shiffrin. She gave us some of the highlights of a typical Passover Seder dinner.
So the very first thing that we do is kadesh, which means to bless or to sanctify. And so you use wine or grape juice to sanctify and bless the day. Then it's karpas, which is the eating of the parsley. Parsley reminds us that there's springtime and renewal and the idea that after this horrible slavery experience, that the rebirth follows the embitterment. We have three matzahs on the table. We break the middle matzah. Half of it is hidden. It's called the afikomen. And during a later point in the Seder, the children at the Seder actually go and they find that. Then there's the magid, which is the telling of the story of the Exodus. God sent plagues, the story says. And the 10 plagues were enough to convince Pharaoh to let us go. And so what we do with the 10 plagues is that we take, the wine is a symbol of our joy and our happiness. So we take with our finger one drop of wine out of the cup for each of the 10 plagues. And we recite what the plagues are as we do it because our wine, our joy, our cup of joy is lessened that there was suffering, there was pain for any people. And then after that, we eat the bitter herbs. Horseradish generally is eaten. And again, that reminds us of the slavery and the tears that we shed when we were slaves in the land of Egypt. So there's this special Hillel sandwich that you eat that's the bitter herbs and the matzah, as opposed to earlier where we ate the bitter herbs and the charoset together. After that, we eat a very elaborate meal. To me, is very interesting is that connection between food and experience.
Thanks to our friend Megan Meyer for putting that piece together. Now to the kitchen with Chef Daniel Orr. Is there something like super cooling about the chef coats or something? Because it's hot back here. How do you do this?
Well, you really do need to wear a t-shirt and a jacket so you're layered. It protects you from the direct heat. So you'd think that it'd be hotter, but it actually protects you from the heat.
That's crazy. Don't wear a button down and a vest because you get really hot.
So today we're talking about religious food, and we're going to do a couple dishes to have around the Passover time. This one is called simas. What it represents is kind of the sweet and sour of life. So what we have is a lot of different root vegetables that we're going to be adding some different ingredients to. And this is a great thing to serve with brisket or roast lamb. It's kind of an accompaniment. It's not really a side vegetable because it's very rich and very full of flavor. I've got a pot going here. Now, there's several different ways you could do this. You could layer it in a baking dish and then put the liquids over it and let it slowly bake. But I'm usually a little bit more pressed for time than that. So we're just going to throw this all in a hot pan. Okay, I've got some orange juice. Now I'm going to throw in some sweet potatoes, some carrots. Now I'm adding some dried fruit. I'm using figs today and some dried apricots. Okay, now we're going to add some spices. We've got some fresh orange peel. Okay, we've got a little bit of brown sugar. We've got some honey, which is going to give us our sweetener. Okay, I'm going to add about a cup of water there, and we're just going to bring that up to a boil, cook it until everything's nice and tender, and that will be our simas.
Simas are traditionally eaten during the Rosh Hashanah meal, but whether it's for a special occasion or not, this dish is great to make this time of year right before your garden starts to take off. Pick up some root vegetables and give it a shot. Now to a recipe for bite-sized potato pancakes often eaten during Hanukkah, latkes.
We've got some nice grated potatoes here. Now, They've oxidized a little bit. You can't see it on the radio, but they're going to be fine because we're going to crisp them up, and they'll be brown and crispy anyhow. So that's fine. We're adding some eggs and to about 2 or 3 cups of grated potatoes. We're adding about 6 eggs, which have been lightly beaten. Okay, now we're going to flavor this up. We're going to add some diced red onion. Of course, our favorite garlic. Something that Grandma might not have put in these, we're going to add a little lemon zest. We love our zest. It gives you the flavor of citrus without giving you the acidity and also the liquid. So anytime you're looking for that kind of punchy, lemony flavor and you don't want to have a lot of acid, add the zest. Okay, we add a little bit of chopped thyme and rosemary, and we're going to finish it with some scallions and a little bit of rice flour. And we just want to have enough flour in there to pull it together so we can form little pancakes with it. And these will be kind of like hash browns almost, little hash brown pancakes. All right, I've got some nice hot oil on. Okay, and I'm just making little mounds of these. Once we get them in and they set, I'm just gonna pat them down a little bit. Again, these you can have for the holidays, but they're great anytime. You can make them a little bit bigger and have them as pancakes for breakfast. They're great to top with some sour cream and smoked salmon for a very elegant kind of canapé. But the kind of the classic way to eat them is with some applesauce and sour cream.
Check out photos of these dishes and reference the recipes from there so you can make them yourself. Our blogger Natalie DeWitt has contributed a couple recipes for homemade chocolate cream eggs and homemade marshmallow chicks. That's right, make your own peeps. Find out how at eartheats.org. Coming up, farmer Joel Salatin talks about the virtues of raising rabbits for meat, and Chef Daniel Orr prepares a rabbit stew using some local meat. Stay with us.
Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods, offering local, organic, and fair trade natural foods with cafe seating on East 3rd Street at the co-op's original location off Kirkwood and on West 6th Street, 2 blocks west of the Courthouse Square. Information at bloomingfoods.coop.
Welcome back to Earth Eats. I'm Annie Corrigan. Farm property taxes are expected to increase by more than a third over the next 3 years. That's because taxes on farmland are calculated differently than regular property taxes. In Indiana, the tax rate fluctuates based on the price of corn. So as WFIU's Gretchen Frazee reports, as long as corn prices keep going up, so will the taxes.
Farming is just about all Ken and Judy Sebastian have ever known. Both of them were raised on farms, and they've been running their own farm, growing soybeans and corn and raising cattle in Morgan County for more than 3 decades.
Rotations is one of the main things. We try to rotate between corn and soybeans.
But as Ken surveys the fields where he'll sow corn soon, he can't help but worry about all the things that are simply out of his control. The past few years have been somewhat of a roller coaster for the Sebastians' business. Corn prices have been higher, but that's only because there's less corn on the market. Dry weather has meant low yields for farmers. Then there's another issue. Taxes. Because corn is the most popular crop in Indiana, farm property tax rates are based on corn prices. The base tax rate for an acre of land was $500 in 2000. The rate is expected to be 4 times that amount, or $2,000 by 2015. The taxes are also on a 4-year lag. So if corn prices drop anytime in the next few years, farmers will be paying high taxes and be getting less money for their crop. Judy Sebastian says it's easy to see how that could put many farmers in a financial dilemma.
I mean, if corn prices do go low, it's going to be painful in a few years because we're going to be, like you say, then the lag will really hurt us.
There's nothing farmers can do to control the price of corn. So the Sebastians have found a way to survive the fluctuations and the unknowns by saving as much as they can. Judy says they have to plan far in advance because they don't get a steady income throughout the year.
We might get a big crop check or a big cattle check, and then we have to set that aside and save it for when we need the money. You know, we can't just go out and blow it. So, but I mean, since we've farmed for so many years, you know, you just learn to, because you know you've got property taxes coming up, you know you've got a tractor payment coming up, so you just have to put it aside and, you know, not touch it.
As Judy trails off, neighboring farmer Warren Beatty drives up in his white pickup truck. He's just come from the courthouse trying to sort out his own taxes.
Well, we got her straightened out. That's all I've been doing this morning is trying to straighten out property taxes that I didn't know. Like I say, there's got to be a better way, but I don't know what it is.
Many farmers are hoping the legislature will consider changing the farm property tax formula next year. Indiana Representative Jeff Espick is the chairman of the State House Ways and Means Committee. He says he doesn't expect any drastic changes. The tax formula has been in place for as long as he can remember, and he says it works well.
I think the system is refined continuously. The Indiana Farm Bureau, for instance, is in the halls of the State House here every day, working in behalf of their membership and reflecting the needs of their members in a fair and honest way. So, old is not necessarily bad.
Espick says nobody likes taxes, but farmland is actually undervalued. So farmers are paying less in taxes than they could be.
Farmers are correct. The value has gone up substantially. But I'll share a little secret. None of them would sell their farm ground for what they pay on assessed value for that land right now.
Back at the farm, the Sebastians say the tax increases could make life a bit tougher. But, like they've always done, they'll come out all right, one way or another. For WFIU News, I'm Gretchen Frazee.
Raising rabbits for food is starting to take off on farms and in backyards alike, and it totally makes sense. Rabbits are healthier, leaner, and a lot friendlier to the environment than most animals. According to Slow Food USA, rabbits can produce 6 pounds of meat on the same amount of feed and water it takes a cow to produce just 1 pound. And for urban farmers, they make a lot more sense than chickens. Rabbits are quieter, less smelly, and they're easier to slaughter. I spoke with a farmer who raises rabbits, Joel Salatin. His Polyface farm was featured in Michael Pollan's book, The Omnivore's Dilemma, and you might recognize him from the documentary Food, Inc. He says rabbit has a lot to offer.
Rabbit is a very dense, it's the most dense protein. In fact, historically, that's one reason why the biggest purchaser, buyer of rabbit in our country has been the military for K rations, for military rations, because the protein is so dense, you don't have to eat very much to feel full. But culturally around the world, I mean, Italy, France, the British, rabbit is extremely common and a real delicacy in all those cultures.
And thanks to chefs like Earth Eats chef Daniel Orr, rabbit is beginning to appear on more and more restaurant menus all over the United States.
We get rabbit from northern Indiana, Gunthorpe Farms, and it's a lot like chicken. You know, a lot of people say that about everything.
Tastes
like chicken. But the domestic rabbit is very mild, so you can use it just like you would do chicken in stews and sautés and fry it and all that kind of stuff. But it's particularly good in stews.
Is a way to make a rabbit stew in no time.
When you buy rabbit, you normally get the whole rabbit. It's probably about a foot long,
It's got some really nice muscular hind legs, which, you know, would be used for jumping. And then you have some smaller little legs up front, which I call rabbit wings. And then in the center is the loin. So that's the long, narrow body. And there's some really nice meat along the two sides of the backbones, which is probably the most prized meat. If you would go to a fancy restaurant, that would be the part they would sell. They would probably debone it and then, you know, stuff it with some wild mushrooms and foie gras, and then wrap it up in some bacon or kalfat, roast it off, and then slice it, and you have a beautiful kind of marble-looking presentation. And then what you want to do is to always make the most use out of your carcass. You can make a stock just like you would make a chicken stock. Just cut it up, roast it, top it with some water, some of those nice root vegetables we talked about in another program. Chop those up and then boil it for about 3 hours, and you'll have a nice rabbit stock that you can make into a soup, just like you would do a chicken soup. Okay, with the kidneys and the liver, they're great just to sauté. You can dredge them a little bit of flour, sauté them. I like to leave them a little pink. Or you could, if you buy a bunch of rabbits, like 5 or 6 rabbits, you could make a little pâté out of them. All right, so we're going to get started on our rabbit stew. So we're going to play off using that real lean meat to create a really nice lean dish. What we're going to do is season the rabbit, a little bit of kosher salt and some of our fresh ground pepper. We always use fresh ground pepper at Earth Eats. Put a little bit of olive oil on top and kind of massage that into the meat. Add just a pinch of cayenne as well as some rosemary and a little bit of fresh thyme. The rosemary has that kind of piney aroma. It's great with tomatoes. Thyme is a really nice kind of earthy, citrusy flavor. And then, of course, we love our garlic at Earth Eats. Okay, a little bit of oil in the pan. We've got a nice preheated pan, and I'm going to add the rabbit. One rabbit will feed about 4 people. Okay, we're just going to let that really brown and kind of caramelize on that first side and then turn them over. And you do this whenever you're making any kind of stew. You brown the meat first, and that intensifies the flavor. It seals in some of the moisture of the meat, and it will give your liquid that you add to it a lot more flavor than if you just were to put it over raw rabbit. Then we're going to add our onions. Okay, as those sweat, which is the culinary term for cooking down and becoming tender, we're going to add a little more rosemary and thyme. We just made a little sachet or bundle of thyme. We'll add that. Okay, we're going to deglaze with some white wine. I'm going to add a little sweetness by adding a touch of honey. I've got some whole peeled tomatoes. I'm just going to coarsely break them up with my hands. Be careful because they will squirt up on you, and don't wear your best white blouse.
He says to the woman holding the microphone wearing a white shirt.
I've done it enough times. I cook in white every day. So
that's true.
I'm going to add a little bit of salt and pepper, and then we're going to cover it and let it simmer for minimum 45 minutes, but it's even better after about an hour, hour and a half.
Then serve it over top of some sautéed greens and polenta. Check out another rabbit recipe on our website for Thai rabbit salad, and send us your rabbit recipes at eartheats@gmail.com. Thanks to everyone who helps make Earth Eats possible, including Gretchen Frazee, Mia Partlow, Chef Daniel Orr, Joel Salatin, Megan Meyer, Rabbi Sue Schifrin, and the entire team at Harvest Public Media.
Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods, offering local, organic, and fair trade natural foods, with cafe seating on East 3rd Street at the co-op's original location off Kirkwood, and on West 6th Street, 2 blocks west of the Courthouse Square. Information at bloomingfoods.coop. Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media. Carrie Boyce, executive producer.
Already looking forward to next week. We'll be ringing in the new year of the Bloomington Summer Farmers Market. And it's a perfect time to get out and forage for your food. We'll feature recipes using dandelion greens and red buds. Enjoy your holiday celebrations this weekend. This is Earth Eats. I'm Annie Corrigan. Thanks for listening.